On the program today, Dodd-Frank, Ralph Lauren, and John Stetson from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 7th of June. Glad you could be here, everybody. Senator Chris Dodd is out of politics. Congressman Barney Frank is out of politics. Their conjoined names, however, are still very much in the political arena. Today, Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling, who has Frank's old job as the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, announced the GOP's preferred alternative to the Dodd-Frank law, the big reform package that came out of the financial crisis, as I'm sure you remember. Whether it's going to go anywhere depends very much on what happens this November, but it is worth a minute, perhaps, to remember what Dodd-Frank was supposed to do in the first place and where things stand now. Marketplace's Jed Kim gets us going.
After the financial crisis of 2008, the Dodd-Frank Act was supposed to institute a lot of regulations to make sure such a collapse never happens again. But did it deliver? Finding out is not a fun homework assignment. The act is dense, complicated. Fortunately, there's a way to cheat. Get answers from people who helped write it. First up, there's Donald Lamsden, counsel for Squire Patton Boggs. Lamsden also helped pen one of the act's most contentious parts, the Volcker Rule.
Well, I wrote the first draft.
It restricts banks from making investments that benefit themselves, not their customers. Lamsden says another big impact is requiring financial institutions to have more capital on hand to cover losses.
And the other one is the creation of the CFPB, which puts another new regulator on the beat.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recently made headlines when it proposed tougher restrictions on payday lenders. Lamsden says while the act was designed to protect, it has had some unintended consequences, such as driving up banks' costs. Which means
the next time one of your listeners goes in for a loan, it's going to be more expensive than it was before.
Others, though, see the sunny side.
Michael Barr, I'm a professor of law at the University of Michigan.
Barr was also an assistant secretary at the Treasury Department and helped write Dodd-Frank. He says the changes have made things safer and fairer. And he says we're seeing economic benefits. Just look at Europe.
On a comparative basis, we're doing much better. And we're doing much better in part because we put in place the policies that were needed early on.
Republicans don't agree. Neither do many of the big banks. As for Lamsden, he says it's way too early to tell. I'm Jed Kim from Marketplace.
There's been another twist and turn in the long, strange trip that is Yahoo's adventure in selling itself. Verizon, according to the Wall Street Journal, thinks Yahoo's core internet business is worth $3 billion. The two companies aren't commenting, but the underlying story here has been around for a while, and you might have heard that Yahoo's valuation is mostly not about Yahoo, but rather the chunks of the Chinese e-commerce company Alibaba and Yahoo Japan that it owns. So, a company putting a $3 billion price tag on plain old Yahoo is interesting. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York now on the ever-moving target that is corporate valuation.
Valuation can be complicated, but it comes down to something quite simple. The value of something is whatever the highest bidder is willing to pay.
You can say that the beauty is in the eye of the individual beholder, or in this case, the individual bidder.
Donna Hitcherich is a Columbia Business School professor and former investment banker.
That's the beauty, right? The beauty is what this asset does for me.
Instead of a company, think of an old racehorse. It's worth nothing to someone dreaming of a triple crown, but could sell a lot of tickets at a petting zoo. Now remember that Verizon already has AOL. If it gets Yahoo, it'll have a petting zoo for fallen 90s internet properties. If Verizon is serious about getting bigger in digital media and advertising, Yahoo's content and billion users could help. Dan Rayburn follows digital media for Frost & Sullivan.
Let's say you combine Yahoo's ad team with AOL's. That's certainly something in the market that could generate a substantial amount of revenue.
But whether it's enough to justify a $3 billion price tag ultimately comes down to the labor of people stuffed in conference rooms, hunched over spreadsheets. Staffers from Verizon and other potential bidders crunch the numbers with help from banking and legal advisors. Some things they know, like how much money Yahoo made in the past. But the ultimate bid rests on assumptions of how there might be more money in doing it differently. Northeastern University business professor Stephen Kirsch says what Verizon learned owning AOL may help.
So they have already, if you will, seen the movie before.
But no spreadsheet says for sure how the movie ends. It can take a while to figure out whether you overpaid. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Here's today's paradox in high-end retail. How do you undilute your brand? Case in point, Ralph Lauren, the company's chief executive, met with analysts today and laid out a whole closet full of details on the once upper crust but now clearly troubled brand's turnaround plan. One key to the whole thing? Less is more. Gigi Duban reports on luxury damage control.
If you shop at Macy's or Kohl's or JCPenney, please don't be offended. But there are people out there who think luxury brands like Ralph Lauren don't even belong in the same sentence as these department stores. Hooman Salem, CEO of Argyle Company, fashion retail consultants, is one of them.
They have no business being in a JCPenney or a Sears or a Kohl's or these types of stores because, again, it's a disconnect between who those customers are and what the brand intends to be.
The brand intends to be luxury. But when department store shoppers come armed with coupons and they buy those brands at a discount, Salem says something happens.
They dilute the brand. They alienate their core customer groups. And as a result, they are now, Prada is one of them certainly, Ralph Lauren, and many others, they're realizing that that was a bad idea.
Russ Weiner is a marketing professor at NYU. He says Ralph Lauren needs to figure out how to keep profit margins high.
Which usually means not only high prices, but also as little discounting as they can.
That means selling less at outlet stores and more at high-end stores like Saks and Nordstrom. Weiner's own take on Ralph Lauren's iconic staple?
To me, it's the polo shirt. I own a few of them. I might have to say I got them at factory outlets.
But he says even with smaller price tags, he's not a fan. Those really big ponies on the shirts? Weiner thinks they're a little garish. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
They're a lot garish, a lot, and don't even get me started on the cologne, all right? Ticker symbol RL, Ralph Lauren or Lauren, take your pick. Off 2% plus today. The major indices a little bit up, a little bit down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On the theory that shorter is sometimes better, a quick conversation now with best-selling author James Patterson. We had him on the program a couple of years ago talking about his formula for writing all those bestsellers. Today, something new, and yes, it does have to do with his fictional hero, Alex Cross, just slightly shorter. James Patterson, good to talk to you again.
Nice to be back.
Why are you doing this? What's the motivation here?
Well, this is Bookshots, and they're 125 to 150-page novels. They'll be priced under $5, and they fly like the wind. I mean, they're very fast-paced. And I think it fits a lot of people's lives now. And what I've tried to do with Bookshots is to take all the fat out of commercial novel. So they're just tight, tight, tight. All thriller, no filler.
Says one of the most prolific commercial writers like ever, right? I mean, you've only sold like a gazillion copies of 400-page
books. Now I'm really prolific. Yeah, they're going to be close to 50 of these a year. And in the year since I introduced my publishers to Bookshots, I have 117 that are almost ready to go now.
Give me the elevator pitch. You walked in to Little Brown and said, "Hey, have I got an idea for you?" And of course, they said yes because you're James Patterson. But what was the pitch?
The pitch was, I'm going to do these books that fly like the wind, and there's a real need for them out in the world, and everybody gets it.
But let me poke you in the eye for a minute here, right? Just about that whole,
sure.
You know, life moves too fast, and people don't have enough time, and this is what they want. Aren't you sort of feeding into that whole, oh my God, I got to get this done, instead of encouraging people to take a minute and sit back with a finely crafted 450-page novel that they can use for a little mental breathing space?
No, because you can't force people to do that. What we can do is get them more in the habit of reading. Then what will follow from that, I think, is that they will read more full-length books. But no, I don't think that's going to happen. And if it happens, that's just the way the world is going. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing sacred about 450-page books either.
Talk to me for a second about genre types of books. I mean, there's a romance novel in this thing, and you're not known for your romance novel writing?
Well, I've written half a dozen love stories, a couple of which I'm very happy with. One of the things, it's very interesting, around the world, you don't hear this. You know, you go to England, you don't get this prejudice this kind of elitist, oh, well, mysteries, oh, romance. They accept it as, you know, mysteries are fair game. They think mysteries are important and good and whatever, and they're comfortable with romance. They don't have to, like, establish who they are by saying, oh, you know, romance novels, oh, mystery novels. You know? It's really in this country that you get that kind of insecurity.
The American reading public is insecure?
I don't think it's the reading public. I think it's the critics for more than anything else. I don't think it's a reading public. A little bit with the reading public.
How are you going to know if this project works? Are we going to do a Pew survey in a year and reading is up, you know, 14% or something?
That'll be a piece of it for sure. You know, a lot of it, I mean, look, you put out, like anything you put out there, I mean, hopefully people vote with their money.
James Patterson. The new series is called Bookshots. It's out today. Mr. Patterson, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Coming up.
The Western hat has saved this company's butt more than once.
Trying on hats with the CEO of Stetson. But first, let's do the numbers. Strong start, sluggish finish today. The Dow Industrials added just 17 points at the bell, a 10th percent, 17,938. They did top 18 grand at one point. The S&P 500 gained 2 points, also a 10th percent, 21,12. The NASDAQ dipped 6 points, a 10th percent again, ended the thing at 49.61. As we told you earlier, the new CEO of Ralph Lauren unwrapped the company's rescue plan today, down 2%. Retailers who reside a little lower on the luxury scale did better, though. JCPenney jumped more than 2%. Kohl's climbed 1.8%. Those reports that the Verizon's going to make a $3 billion bid for Yahoo sent the telecommunications company shares up 2%. Yahoo shares, which do seem to know only one direction, down 0.9% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note dipped to 1.71%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Highs for the year for crude oil today, $50.36 a barrel at the close in New York for the West Texas Intermediate variety. And yes, it could and quite possibly will drop tomorrow because that's what commodity prices do. They move. But the basic premise that oil is at relative lows still does hold. In the past 16 months or so, oil and gas companies in Texas have laid off more than 80,000 workers. From San Antonio, Brenda Salinas reports that some of them have found work in solar.
David Webster has been managing this noisy solar panel warehouse since February of last year.
No, actually, it's a lot louder on a rig than it is in here. A lot louder on a rig. I spent 10 years doing that, and I loved it, but I like this a lot more.
Webster was in charge of shipping oil out of rigs all over the world. Now he manages 50 people at Mission Solar in San Antonio. He makes sure that the solar panels, he calls them modules, are ready to go, packaged, and distributed to customers across the U.S.
In some aspects, learning about the different types of modules, learning how the whole process works, yeah, that was a learning curve. The warehouse portion of it and managing people, not so much.
And there's something else that's different about his new job, the money.
Over a year's period of time, it's about half.
Maria La Cruz is a hiring manager at OCI Power, which manages 5 solar farms. She says that 50% pay cut is pretty typical for people transitioning from oil and gas to solar.
Not to say that we don't pay well or anything like that, but definitely we know that there is a pay differential for those employees.
An entry-level job in solar pays about $50,000 a year. At the peak of the oil boom, rig hands could be making upwards of 6 figures. But warehouse manager David Webster says it was a hard life. 28 days on the rig, 28 days off, plus the recent uncertainty in the oil market.
The stress of not knowing if you were going to get laid off, that was worse. I don't have any stress here.
It's certainly attracting people from traditional energy. When Maria La Cruz posts an opening for a solar technician, for example, she gets about 100 candidates, of which 25% come from oil and gas. Her challenge is to weed out those who will leave once oil prices go up again.
You can generally tell that they are trying to make a different transition, that they maybe are tired of the ups and the downs. And there are some that will actually candidly tell you, well, I'm only looking for something until the market changes. And you're like, okay, thank you.
Yeah, they don't get the job. the Solar Foundation says Texas will add 900 solar jobs this year. That's about 1% of the people who recently got pink slips in oil and gas. John Tintera is with the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers. He says there's no way this new industry can absorb all those displaced workers.
We simply are not seeing solar having that level of employment. If solar continues to grow, then I would think that at least a 20% coverage would be something that would not surprise me if I saw that figure in the future.
But for now, hiring manager Mariela Cruz says getting a job in solar energy is more competitive than ever. She does have one bit of advice for oil and gas workers wanting to make the transition. Don't pretend to be a tree hugger and all about renewable energy after a whole career on the oil field.
After you've done that for 20 years, it's kind of hard to really say, can I really take that with a grain of salt or not?
Cruz hopes that the people she hired this year will stay on board, even when oil prices go back up. In San Antonio, I'm Brenda Salinas for Marketplace.
On the list of things most iconically American, somewhere near the top, will be the tall crown and wide brim of the Stetson hat, named for founder John B. Stetson some 150 years ago. It's a symbol of Western pride, American entrepreneurialism, and in no small measure, personal style. John Wayne to Garth Brooks. Stetson Worldwide, as the company is now known, though, is not the Stetson of old, whose plant in Philadelphia was in its day the biggest hat factory in the world. Today, a plant in Garland, Texas, does the making of Stetsons. The staff at a showroom in Manhattan's Fashion District does the marketing and branding. And running it all since 2012 is CEO Izumi Kajimoto, who spent a 27-year career in fashion at places like Calvin Klein and Donna Karan. So, when we visited a couple of weeks ago, I got right to the hats as fashion question.
There's a great quote from you somewhere in the literature that I was reading. Mm-hmm. You think American men are I'm paraphrasing, are afraid to look silly wearing hats or something like that.
Yeah.
We're fashion chickens, right?
I've been doing this for a while, and relatively speaking, I think American men tend to be conservative compared to, you know, more fashion conscious or just the average European and Asian man. But that's part of the challenge. And I think hats are a further challenge to that circumstance because it's on your head.
Yeah,
it is on your head,
and you're walking around with it. And
uh-huh.
If it doesn't look great, if you haven't got the right head on the right hat, or the right hat on the right head,
yeah. Well, it's more than the head; it's the face. You know, hat.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, the hat covers your head, but it surrounds your face, and it's as such, it really is the most intimate article on your person.
Is it okay with you that if I said Stetson to 10 people out there, they would say, oh yeah, big Western cowboy hats?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's reality, and that's what creates our jobs. The Western hat has saved this company's butt more than once. For the first time in its establishment and creation, because it is the Western hat that caused John B. Stetson to be successful. Rather than be, you know, lose competitively to all the dress hat makers of the time, he created a new hat.
Do you guys have, I mean, you know, is Christmas a busy time for you? Spring?
Yes,
the hat season?
Holidays, very,
really?
Very
People
very
like give
important.
Hats for Christmas?
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
holidays?
Yeah. It's interesting. That kind of tugs at my business mind a bit because hats are extremely intimate and personal. Extremely.
Mm-hmm.
And even for this, you know, self-conscious, conservative American man, just because your wife or girlfriend tells you you look great in something.
Oh, yeah, no, forget it. No chance.
Yeah, you might be okay in her presence. You might be okay to walk out of the house.
Maybe.
But, you know, the second your buddy says...
what are you doing? Right,
yeah,
that's exactly
that,
it.
That, yeah,
that's exactly
yeah.
it.
So it's extremely personal. And, you know, I treasure the holidays, which is, you know, a big uptick in sales for sure, and we know that a lot of it is from gifting. What's more important to me is creating a repeat customer out of that guy. You know, that's how that needs to be leveraged.
So this is more than you need to know, but when my dad died, mm-hmm. I got a hat from him that he'd had for probably 15 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think dad died 11, 12 years ago, whatever it is. I've worn it twice, and it's in my closet. Because mm-hmm. I don't look bad in it, mm-hmm. but I put it on, and I go out of the house, and I'm like, oh, no. And I turn around and go back in.
And then there's, you know, for every person like you, we've met 5 or 10 who have that exact same story yeah. and do wear that hat every day wow. and come to us and ask, you know, I don't want to wear it to death because it's my dad's. Can I get a new one? And we have it. Huh. We have it. Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to show you.
I was just going to say, I have to try on some of those hats mm-hmm. now. All right, so mm-hmm. let's give that away.
Knock yourself out.
Well, I don't even know. All right, so we'll go with the cowboy hat first, right?
Yeah.
Now, what is this that I have?
Beautiful color. Check it out.
Wow. All right, yeah. So it's a sort of a dark grayish. Mm-hmm. Wide brim. Mm-hmm.
It's a little fancy because right. it's got silver fittings on the...
Silver little belt buckle
thing. On the band.
I'm going to sound really stupid. Mm-hmm. How do I know it's on forward or backward?
Goes on the back. Right, yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay. We drop hints everywhere.
All right. Well, thank God.
Yes,
brim goes up or brim goes down?
To your taste.
Really?
Yeah.
It's called a snap. Fundamentally, it's all to my taste, right?
Absolutely.
I like this color and I like the look.
Wonderful. And the cool thing is we have hipsters and rock stars wearing them, and they look great in that, too.
Yeah, but see, you can be a hipster and a rock star and get away with it. You can't be like me, average Joe.
Wish I can.
That's the catch.
Yes, you can.
Well, and it's all the mental.
You're challenging me on everything that I just said. And it's like, is this a...
I'm not trying to challenge you. I'm just...
No, it's a daily challenge.
I'm your potential market.
Exactly.
Right? Because I would really love. I mean, if you know, I would love to be able to have the flair and the...
You do. It's not your responsibility to find the flair. It's our responsibility yeah. to propose the hat.
And then to be able to have the panache to say, you know what? I like this hat, even if everybody else doesn't.
You don't think about everybody. You don't address the void. You don't address the negative. You enhance the positive.
Well, I will say this. I will at least keep an open mind. How about that?
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not about how do I look. How do I look? You'll know.
All right.
There is a hat for every head.
Who designs your hats? I mean, do you?
It's collaborative, but. The nuts and bolts designer is located at the factory. It's very hands-on.
And he or she sits there and says, well, I'm going to make the brim this wide and the crown this high.
Yeah,
and the
cup. Yeah, really? Yeah, yeah. There's a you know. And once again, I'm gonna throw a random parallel out there. Let's say sunglasses and eyewear. Another thing mm-hmm. that goes
on
your face.
Right.
It's a matter of eighths of inches and millimeters makes the total difference. You know, everything that you're talking about. Now, I'm not a hat guy. I look like I look like that. A quarter inch makes a difference in these minutiae. And the designers are very rare, you know, whether it's trend or just the idea of flattering every face right. type, every attitude, they're experts on it.
I was talking to Alan Mulally once when he was the CEO of Ford, and mm-hmm. we had a conversation about the manufacturing process. And mm-hmm. I asked him, you know, who decides where the taillights go, what shape they are, and this and that? I mean, who has the final sign off? And he said, me. Who decides what Stetson hats look like in the final analysis?
It's not one person. Hmm. It's not one person. It's a consensus. Majority in the production and manufacturing end because, you know, they are very, very hands-on. But that's also our job. There's a reason why we're in New York.
Right.
There's a reason why the people who staff this office are of the background that we are. It's because we need to not follow, but lead. And that's where the idea of a viable, powerful, relevant company has to have is, you know, knowing what people want, will covet as an object of desire, maybe even before they do. So it's a group effort for sure.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Izumi Kajimoto, the CEO of Stetson Worldwide. We've got the whole interview that we did on the latest Corner Office podcast. New episodes drop every other Tuesday, available however you choose to get your podcasts. I am, before you ask, pretty sure we destroyed all the pictures of me trying on those hats, I think. Final note on the way out today, General Mills is doing something it hasn't done in 15 years, introducing a new breakfast cereal.
It's called Tiny Toast. Comes in strawberry and blueberry flavors. Flavors that the company says are actual strawberry and blueberry powder, whatever that is. No artificial flavors involved. The Christian Science Monitor, however, does note that Tiny Toast has 9 grams of sugar per serving, on a par with other mainstays of that sugary cereal camp, Reese's Puffs and Frosted Cheerios. So, you know, ixnay in my house, eh? The Dow up 17 points today, about a 10th percent. The Nasdaq down 6 points, a 10th percent there. The S&P 500 gained 2 points also, oh gosh, a 10th percent. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.